A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I'm still the aforementioned Chase Thomas coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. We got a two-parter here on the program today here on the Blue Wire Pod Network. Go check out all the other great shows all across the Blue Wire Pod Network, whether that's Long Shot with Duncan Robinson, Green Light with Chris Long, Wide Receiver One with Chris Carter, just all kinds of great shows all across the Blue Wire Pod Network. So go check all those out if you have not already done so as well. On today's show, we got a two-parter, as I mentioned, to kick things off here. We got to start things off, we got Fangraph's John Taylor talk about the Braves and their hot win streak. Casey Mize going down for the year for the Tigers. Is it time for Tony La Russa to move on in Chicago? The Jays losing Ryu for the season, and a lot more with John Taylor. That's how we'll start things off here on Hour 1 here on the Wednesday, June 15th, 2022 edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Coming up right after Hour 2, we got Pitt Panthers coverage. Yeah, Panthers Lair with Jim Hammett to talk all things Pitt, Jordan Addison, Slovis, Whipple's departure, the Tennessee Pitt game coming up this fall. But that's coming up after this on the next episode, Hour 2, here on this very feed. But guess what? If you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or however you get your podcasts, you will not miss any of today's shows. So make sure you're subscribed so you do not miss any of those said shows. Don't forget, you can check us out on YouTube, youtube.com/ChaseThomasPodcast. Make sure you like and subscribe. All kinds of video content over there. Read me at sportsrenaissancefan.substack.com. Wrote about Tennessee baseball and just kind of a reflection of where we're at a couple of days removed from their upset loss to Notre Dame on Sunday. So you can read that and all my sports writing over there at sportsrenaissancefan.substack.com. Type in your email and become a subscriber today. That would be great. Email the program at chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. Tweet at me at @chase_Thomas. Like the Facebook page at facebook.com/ChaseThomasWriter. All right, Hour 1 with Fangraph's John Taylor coming up in just 1 second. Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to another edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast, taping this on a Tuesday afternoon. It's not nightfall yet because the New York City skyline is not behind John.
You can't even see what's behind me. Hold on, I'm trying to see if I block out the sun and then quickly. Oh, there. You kind of had it for a second.
It seems like you're in heaven. You're basically, what's behind John is what a lot of folks describe when they have a near-death experience. What they see, that's what's behind John on YouTube.com.
What, Hudson Yards? That's kind of depressing if when you die you go.
No, you don't see any. See, on my end, John, you don't see that. All you see is just a bright light. That's all
that's
I'm seeing.
Fair. Yeah,
you got like a green screen for bright light.
I encourage people if they do have a moment where they do see a bright light, run directly toward it.
Yes.
The bright light is good.
The bright light is good, John. John, it's a hot one. And what I've realized, I was on a walk last night with the fiance and walking around the neighborhood, and there is a really nice neighbor on the corner who I always wave at. She sees me when I walk Khaleesi the dog. She sees me when I'm running around the neighborhood. She sees me when I'm taking my walk to do my planning and thinking stuff out for the day. And I always wave. The problem is, John, we have not gotten past the weather back and forth, and then we move our separate ways. And I realized, because Always Sunny in Philadelphia is one of my favorite shows, that I have become the hot one guy in the neighborhood, where it's like, it's a hot one. And yeah. I just imagine, like, somebody's going to do a Dennis Reynolds to me at some point.
So someone is going to get nude and threaten you.
Yes. Not, it won't be a dream, though, because that was like a dream. That was a fantasy in Dennis Reynolds' head.
As far as we know.
Yes.
The line between, the line for Dennis Reynolds between things he actually does and things he only thinks he has done seems purposefully vague in some cases. But yes, that was a dream sequence.
Well, I guess when you get older, John, it's just, I never thought I'd be that guy who's like, man, can you believe this weather? And that is exactly who I am in the neighborhood.
See, but are you doing it to total strangers, though?
Total strangers? No, it's more of like, you talk to me, that's my fallback, where it's like, man, yeah.
How about this weather?
Yeah, that's my fallback, because generally speaking, I feel bad, because the fiance and I, she's a very, very different person in terms of public settings and things like that, and a lot of people misconstrue that because I host a podcast that I'm like a social butterfly and that I'm an extrovert, and that is the farthest thing from for me.
What about speaking into a microphone constantly, usually alone, makes people think that podcasting is for social people?
I don't know, but they do. They really think it's for social people, and it's not. I feel like you're more on my end, where you're not really like the most social, like extroverted guy.
No. I mean, I have my circle of friends, and I have my social stuff. But yeah, I'm not out there all the time. I'm not pressing the flesh, or you know, I would make a terrible politician in that regard.
Oh yeah, like I would be. People would see right through me immediately. Yeah. Like how much I don't want to meet them is just very, very apparent on my face. And that's the whole thing. Is like, it's not against them. It's not against my neighbors who I sigh if I see them. There's one who I really enjoyed. He's another Sam actually, and he's great to talk to, and he's a lot of fun. And he always has treats for Khaleesi, and that's fun. But we know each other now. Like Sam and I, we have that back and forth. We know each other. We're aligned politically. We talk about other things. Like it's just more of like one of those things where it's pretty good friendship. I know him. I like him. I like talking to him. But that takes some time, and everyone else is just not on that radar for me. So I don't want to have the fake conversation for 30 seconds to a minute. Like I don't have it in me. And I told the fiance, I was like, one of the funny things about us is like, you're going to be the one who has to explain me it, wherever we live in the neighborhood, where someone's going to come up to you and be like, dude, do we do something? Why does Chase not like us? And she's going to have to be like, it's not that he doesn't like you. He talks on a podcast a lot. He just doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to hang out.
You're not built for that out of city life. The nice thing about living in a city is you don't have to talk to anybody. I always found it so weird when I've traveled outside of New York and I've been doing stuff like just buying something somewhere, you know, a meal or something. And the person I'm ordering from or whoever will just kind of strike up a very casual conversation or just kind of be like, how are you doing today? And I'll just be like, why are you talking to me?
Right.
Don't talk to me. Like, not in like an unfriendly, like never look at or speak to me kind of way. But just, I'm just not used to that idea of like, oh, hey, interacting with people like just like that. That's not a skill set I have. You know, I gotta work my way into it, I think.
Well, in the South, like, the Southern hospitality is a real thing. And these people are nice, and they're kind, and they generally want to connect. And that's just not how I am. I've always felt like I have, like, a New York vibe about me, where I do not have any interest in that.
Just don't care.
No.
You gotta do a full Jay Cutler the next time your neighbor tries to sell you something. You just lean your head back and go, don't care, keep going.
But that's how it is, man. Like, I don't want to do it. That and my rule, don't get involved. We see it all the time around us. It's like, oh, don't get involved. What are you doing? That's how you get killed.
It's not how you get killed.
Sometimes, John, it is how you get killed. Don't be a hero. That's my way of going about things. Which naturally brings us to a hero on the mound in 1965. Naturally. Did you like that, John?
It was just seamless.
Seamless transition. 1965. I really enjoyed this national pastime today, John. Go check out nationalpastime.com if you have not already. It's great, great website to check out every day. But for today, my favorite one, today in Major League Baseball history, 1965, June 14th, quote, Red starter Jim Maloney, who strikes out 18 batters, no hits the Mets for 10 innings, but loses 1-0 when Johnny Lewis connects for a homer in the 11th in Crosley Field contest, in August at Wrigley Field. The right-hander will again give up no hits through the first 9 innings, but records a no-hitter when his teammate Leo I'm butchering that, so I apologize. Connects in the top of the ninth, providing the only run in Cincinnati's 1-0 victory over Chicago. John Maloney, he was getting killed, and he was giving it his all for Cincinnati. And just when I read these stats, man, a different era, man. These guys, 18 strikeouts, we'll pitch to the 23rd inning. Who cares? Like, if our arm falls off, our arm falls off. Just a completely different thing. It's pretty wild, the stats from this era.
What's funny to me about that is if you went up to someone on the street or to a baseball fan and said, hey, a guy named Jim Maloney threw a 10-inning no-hitter but lost, what year did this happen? Just based on the name alone, I probably would have been like, 1896. But... The strikeouts are really the only thing, though, because that continuum of baseball history from really the beginning up until, like you're saying, through the 60s and the 70s and then the 80s and even into the 90s was one of just pitchers just threw an absurd amount of innings all the time. The major change was, like I said, in the early days, you didn't really strike anyone out. In the latter days, you actually started striking guys out more often. But I've said it before, and I'll say it again, the way baseball looks and exists now is... in so many ways, so radically different from the sport that's existed the 120-ish years previous, particularly in that one way where the role of the pitcher has changed dramatically in the last 10 years, in the last 20, really, but especially in the last 10. So it's interesting to know that, like, we are, as part of that conversation about, what in this game changes with the, or what about this game, better said, with all the changes that have happened to this game, the history of it and stuff like that, it's just going to seem not just more and more kind of outlandish and crazy, but we're also going to get further and further away from those things actually happening. The era where guys would throw 250 to 300 innings in a year, the era where guys would, throw double-digit complete games, the era of 300-game winners and 4,000 career innings and all that stuff, that has changed. That is no longer with us anymore. That part of baseball does not really exist anymore.
Is it okay for me to say, like, it's not a problem because it, like you said, it is what it is, but just be like, that's probably worse for the sport. That's not good.
I don't know if you can attach a good or bad judgment to that. I mean, it just depends on both what version of the sport you grew up in and, what version of the sport you find most aesthetically appealing.
I think it's just easier for the fan. Like, it's easier to be like, yes, Here's our guy. He's pitching 7 innings. He's going to go for a while. Like, I don't have to memorize all of our bullpen arms. I don't have to wonder opener.
One of the most frustrating things about modern day baseball is the sheer number of faceless, mostly anonymous middle relievers, long relievers, openers, AAA call-ups where they're here for 2 minutes and then they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the great majority of them have careers that last maybe a handful of years before they float out of the game entirely.
Right.
That part isn't necessarily new. I mean, players have always been floating in and out of the game for short bits of time. But I do think you're right that it robs us essentially of the character. So much of baseball has just been, the narrative of, if two teams face each other, that contest is personified literally by two pitchers facing each other. The batters change, the batter changes with every single at bat, but the pitcher is there inning through inning, and we don't have that anymore. And I think it is a loss just in terms of how we like baseball as a narrative and how we like the continuity of it. And to have this version of baseball now where it just feels like you see a million players a game and there's no real interconnectedness to any of it, it's just kind of, I don't know. It's hard to say whether one is better or worse than the other. I mean, I certainly prefer the days when you'd see a starter go 6 or 7 innings or throw complete games on this. Like, we all loved, the days of Roy Halladay or or you know, that stretch where CC Sabathia threw like nine complete games in the second half of the season with Milwaukee, like, we're probably never going to see anything like that again. And that's the other part of it. It's not just that this doesn't exist. It will probably never exist again.
Yeah, you're not going to talk these guys into that. Like, it's backwards. Yeah.
If only because baseball players now are such a expensive commodity from beginning to end, you know, from...
You want to protect,
You want to protect them. You know, they are not just players. They are an investment that these teams make, and they want to protect that investment not only for as long as they can... Well, they not only want to protect the investment for as long as they can, but they also want to extract the most they can out of it in a certain period of time. And the most efficient way to do that, at least, seems to be by having these guys throw five innings apiece or whatever, and using as many relievers as possible, because that also fits the efficiency of baseball as what is the best way to get outs. You know, and that, and everything that we've learned about the third time through the order, about how, you know, physical exhaustion affects your ability to pitch and all that fun stuff, that's not changing anytime soon necessarily. And I, you know, maybe there's some team out there that has some magical plan for training its pitchers to be, you know, to have more physical stamina, or to have, you know, to do something with regards to pitch delivery or sequencing that mitigates the third time through the order penalty. But I think it's pretty safe to say that the version of baseball that exists now, like, obviously it is not the version that existed before, but I think it's pretty safe to say that we're never going back to those days.
Well, it does kind of still exist in college baseball. As someone who has watched a bunch of college
baseball. It does, but and I think that that is a reflection, too, of the way that, you know, those that college teams and professional teams just prioritize their guys differently. You know, for college teams, it doesn't really matter what career a dude goes on to have after they graduate. All you care about are the innings they can provide you right then and there. And
well,
also,
college teams usually only have,
like, what, like three or four good pitchers, generally? They don't. I mean, you only develop
really
three
is
or
so
four
hard
starters.
To say.
You have one closer you use all the time because he's your best reliever by a mile and a half. Like, that's also the case. Like a major league baseball team. You know, we can complain about, oh, there's so many like anonymous middling relievers, but every single pitcher on a major league baseball team is worlds better than any single pitcher than the best college baseball player, the best college baseball pitcher currently on the earth. Is probably not good enough to be in the worst bullpen in Major League Baseball right now.
Ooh, I don't know about that. I think Ben Joyce actually might be someone they would give an inning to. I think
that's
he'd probably
fair.
Get some inning.
If only because he throws 105 with certain stuff. Like, but
and Kevin
Cobb
was kind of like that last year with Arkansas. Like, I think you'll see him. Has he even been, like, where is he at right now?
I don't know. That's the thing. Since I don't follow the draft, I don't necessarily know where these guys end up. I mean, more often than not, like, the only guys you'll see really make that jump quickly are guys who are relievers in
the
college.
The flamethrower guys, where they're, like, trying to get them in there. So they're like, before the arm blows out, like, let's just get him up immediately.
Exactly. Like, a dude who throws super, like a Chris Sale, where it's like, no, we don't really have a lot of time with this guy, and, like, trying to make him do something different would be pointless, so... Godspeed.
Yeah, like Ben Joyce is probably gonna be in the majors like in a year or two. Like they're hot-shotting.
I assume if he's drafted by a contending team, they will probably put not rush him necessarily, but they will probably have him in the majors within a year. Especially because as a college reliever, he's going to go straight to high A. You know, there's no real point to having him waste time in rookie ball or in low A. He's just going to go straight to where he is age appropriate. Because they're only going to be throwing him one or two innings at a time anyway, unless some team really wants to give him a shot as a starter, which...
I don't think that's happening.
Just depends on who drafts him. But regardless, like, you can still see that in college baseball, if only because, again, the priorities are very different down there. But I wonder how much that changes, too, because, you know, you do have a part of... I see Keith Law do this a lot, and I think it's top of mind for a lot of evaluators and for a lot of baseball analysts and for a lot of people who care about the sport. You know, how much longer are colleges going to get away with doing that? How much longer a college is going to get away with having a guy throw 120 pitches or more in an outing, or bringing a guy back on 2 days rest to close out a game, or just to pitch the first few innings of a... I mean, obviously the College World Series complicates that because, like the playoffs, you know, you just have to do whatever you can to survive in advance. But I do wonder if we're going to reach a point where somewhere... I mean, maybe it's already happening. Again, I'm not clued into the college game. But where we get to the point where we stop seeing guys go that long in college games too, and then as it, you know, trickles further on down into high school games, into travel ball, into that circuit, you know, at what point we basically just stop developing starters as guys who go more than four or five innings at a time, and baseball becomes a game where it really is just about who has a deeper overall pitching staff and a flexible pitching staff, you know, that can be used kind of as on an as needed basis.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's going to depend, like, what you're seeing now a little bit is that, like, Tennessee treats their first-round prospect guys differently, where it's like there's more safety, where it's like, hey, we're going to take care of you, because you also, it's a recruiting thing. Like, you want to take care of, and I think players all know that. Like, they know this guy's going first round, so he's getting more protection than someone who has no chance of getting drafted or is not a early round pick. So it's like, we saw that over the weekend. I think it was Georgia Tech's arm. He was like, he threw 100 and something pitches last weekend, and he kept going, and they left him in because, like, you go to the bullpen, it was over. Like, Tennessee was going to mash whoever they put in for this guy. And he was, right. I'm sure you have those conversations where you're like, how are you feeling?
And because again,
if we pull you, like, this is it. Like,
that's the thing. Like, you only have so many options as a college coach
as
to what you can do. And like you said, there are some players you're going to treat them better, but there are some players where it's like, yeah, man, like, and I think there probably are guys too who
I'm
going to
be an accountant after this. Like,
yeah, it's like
whatever
they understand
happens.
They're not going pro. This is where they top out, and they're probably, you know, I don't know what conversations they have with their coaching staff, but it's probably like, hey, listen, you don't have to baby me. Like,
yeah,
you know, I will pitch as many, and like, these are all grade A hyper competitive dudes too.
Yes.
Like, they do not want to pitch. So. But I do think it'll be interesting to see now that, you know, we've seen this in Major League Baseball where guys, you know, we do not get Jim Maloney's anymore, is to what extent that's going to start rippling down into college ball, into high school ball, into all levels of amateur baseball, and what that means going forward as to, you know, will we ever get a
I think it's just
like
okay to admit that, like, hey, baseball's changing and that's part of it, and like, we have no
has to change. Baseball can't stay static forever. The sport has to change, and if nothing else, the sport will be changed by external forces like money, science, culture. Like, all these things do have an impact.
Two things can
on
be true, John. You're
grows.
Not going to believe this. Two things can be true where there's some nuance involved where it's like, hey, this is probably better for pitchers and players in this game, and also not as good for the fans. It's just
I think the frustrating thing is so many of the innovations and things that are new to the game do feel like they are not particularly fan friendly. Like,
right.
Defensive shifts, more bullpen usage. Those things are all, they exist because
they're smart,
the people in charge
and better
of baseball. Yeah. They, mm-hmm. they are designed to get outs more efficiently. And the whole point of a baseball game is to get 27 outs, you know, and win the ball game. So
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a whole long conversation about how the extra efficiency of baseball is not particularly aesthetically pleasing, and is probably doing an impact. I don't know how big an impact on, you know, on fan approval, on, you know, attention, on all that stuff. But yeah,
if you're the Pirates, it helps to have, if you have an arm, a starter who is like, you want to come see, because it's a marketing thing. Where if you have a young Gerrit Cole who's going 7-8, even if it's a losing effort. Like, it's still better when those guys have, like, you're a bad team and you still have someone who is a must-see attraction for
a bad team. Yeah, no, they're recognizable. And I think this is something that I remember with the Orioles in the depths of their tanking phase, where it's like, what are you offering these fans when they come to the ballpark and they see a dude on the mound who they don't know and is only going to last 3 or 4 mostly crappy innings? I mean, it's hard. I don't know how as a team you kind of figure that out, especially because there's also the element to it that, you know, you let that pitcher, you let that starter throw 7 innings on the regular if you have that guy. Guess what? He's going to get more and more expensive more quickly as time goes on. You know, those guys are the ones who make the most money. It is not at all a coincidence that an era of maximized financial efficiency in baseball also coincides with baseball becoming what feels like an increasingly faceless game in terms of, you know, at least in terms of the starting pitcher. Like, the opener is not just a strategy designed to win ball games. It is a strategy designed to keep costs down by lessening your dependence on those big name starters who cost the most money, and by essentially creating that endless churn of players that is just more cost effective overall. You know, there's less service time being going around there. More guys are picking up a greater share of innings. You know, that's all part and parcel of it. That is what baseball's decision makers want the sport to be. They want it to be not just more efficient on the field, but they want it to be more efficient financially. And stuff like that goes a big way to making it more efficient financially, you know?
Yeah. And happier news, John. The Braves are actually not going to lose another baseball game. I don't know if you heard this. Did you see this? Did you hear about this?
I mean, I know they lost the second baseman.
Okay. That was not necessary, but hey, you know what, like, it sucks, fractured foot for Ozzie, You can't replace him. They're going to struggle without Ozzy in that spot for a while. They recalled
Phil
Goose.
Gosselin.
Yeah, Goose.
So Phil Gosselin is the most, like, I keep thinking that's the name of, like, I guess it's because it's the same name as the John and Kate people. Is their last name Gosselin? Something like that?
Are you talking about the John and Kate plus eight or the gigantic
those
family?
Reality couple weirdos. Yeah. Every time I see his name, I just have a weird moment where it's like, that's not a real person.
Goose.
Sorry.
The Goose
sorry
is
to
loose.
Phil Gosselin.
Yeah.
Atlanta must always have one crappy utility infielder at all times.
Where is Kelly Johnson when you need him?
Where's Charlie Culberson when you need him?
Clutch Charlie? That guy, I would kill for some Charlie Culberson right now.
Do you think he went, when he went out, he introduced himself to people as Dansby Swanson?
Hmm.
Like, do you think he tried to pass off as Dansby? Because he really could.
He really could. I don't know. It's a good question.
But anyway, Braves are good now.
Braves are really good right now. They're hitting. I will say people are leaning in a little bit too much. Look, Matt Olson, fellow Parkview kid. Shout out to the Parkview Panthers and the great baseball program we got for the alma mater. But he's not an all-star first baseman. I always think it's kind of funny when I see, like, the teams pushing all, like, the Braves should have the whole all-star infield. That should be where we're at. And it's like, well, no, no, like, we don't have to do this. Like, that's not a thing that we have to do. And I'm also like, am I just a weird fan where I could never sign my name to it? Where I'm like, have you seen the first baseman grouping this year? Like, he's just not even in the conversation based on what he's done to this point. Like, he's been good. He hasn't been great. He's been good, but he's just not an all-star this year. Matt Olson, he has a lot of time. He's locked up long-term, but he's not an all-star this year. He hasn't had an all-star type year, but the Rays are good. Michael Harris has been a huge shot in the arm. He hits his first home run this week. He's been great. Acuna is 100% back. Dansby is probably the biggest crazy outlier of all of this, is that him in the two-hole is just he's really good right now. Like, it's not sustainable. I think a lot of folks are like, you got to pay him. Like, people who are worried about Liberty Media paying Dansby Swanson this offseason, like, okay, let's calm down. Like, there's still a lot of at-bats remaining here where it's like, this is great. And he's a big reason why the Braves are, what, five games back, five and a half now of the Mets. They've made up a bunch of ground there. My gut tells me they're probably leading this division by July, but we'll see. They're clicking all across the board, and Max Fried has been sensational. Spencer Strider's good. I'm curious to see what his long-term upside is here, but you know, the Braves been a really, really good baseball team for a while now, and I am not certain they lose in the month of June, John. Can't say I'm certain of it.
I appreciate this particularly bold stance on your part. I mean, they've got two more games against the Nationals, then followed by three against the Cubs. So they definitely shouldn't lose until next week at this point.
Right.
The interesting thing to me is looking at Atlanta's schedule going forward. After that, they finished that stretch against going to Washington and going to Chicago. A really big seven-game series at home against both the Giants and the Dodgers, followed by a three-game series at the resurgent Phillies. And then, of course, the really, really big one right before the All-Star break, or not right before, but just right before, a three-game series with the Mets at home starting July 11th. So, yeah, I mean, the biggest thing, as you mentioned, is they have cut that division lead in half. They have significantly improved their playoff chances per... Jay Jaffe wrote a very thorough look at, you know, how the Braves have come back into this race. Acuna is obviously a lot of it. Michael Harris, as you mentioned, is a lot of it. The rotation, which has been good, mostly aside from Ian Anderson and Charlie Morton, who have been pretty meh.
But that's a good spot to be in, where you're like the young guys who you, in Kyle Wright not being someone you could count on before the season, and now he's someone you're in. He's 12 starts in. Like, Kyle Wright's for real.
Yeah, but again, like, at the end of May, the Braves had a 16%, roughly 16% chance to win the NL East, and a 60% chance of making the playoffs per our odds at Fangraphs. Now, after this 12-game win streak, amid this 12-game win streak, because it's not over yet, their division odds have climbed all the way to 34%, and their playoff odds are all the way up to 83. So this is substantial. They have made a really substantial move back into this. What's also worth noting about this is they've done it at the same time as the Phillies have gotten hot. You know, they won nine of their last 10. They are now only 8.5 games back in the division and 3.5 games back of a wild card spot. So a very needed, necessary surge for Atlanta because, I mean, look, were the Mets going to be this good all season? Probably not. There will be regression. There will be ebbs and flows. But they couldn't come into July still trailing the division by double digits. You know, it's really unlikely they were going to be able to pull off the same trick twice. Mm. I mean, granted, they will hopefully now at least have Acuna for the rest of the season as opposed to last year where they had to cobble together an outfield on the fly. But yeah, this is a really big winning streak for them to get them back into that conversation. And also to start raising the question now of like, okay, well, now what do we do next? You know, looking at this team, what still needs to improve for them to go from, okay, we're back in the conversation to now we're actually, you know, back to being the division favorites and being real contenders and what have you. You know, what is kind of missing for this team right now, if anything? I mean, the one thing that stands out to me is that, you know, that bullpen that was so integral in bringing a World Series to Atlanta last year, it has not really been the same. I mean, Kenley Jansen has been great since coming over. AJ Minter continues to be great.
Yep.
But they're down Tyler Matzek right now.
He was bad, though, before he
Will
down,
Smith
yeah.
has been... Will Smith bad. Was not great last year, but he has been worse this year.
Yeah.
They've lost Luke Jackson for the year after he blew out his elbow. Strider was a guy I mean, I maybe could have been a kind of impact relief guy. Obviously, they're going to, you know, use him as a starter to see how that goes. But, you know, I think for me it's a question of, okay, now what are the pieces that are still needed to turn this from simply a winning streak into the start of actual contention again? Or is it something as simple as...
Wait, would you rather invest the summer in another dependable arm, like starter, or would you rather just add to the bullpen?
I mean, I don't know. It obviously depends on... It depends on health, more importantly than everything. It depends on whether Anderson and Morton can get back on track.
Yeah. It depends, and then the wild card being Soroka.
Yeah, I was going to say, it also depends on what, if anything, Mike Soroka can contribute, because truthfully, it doesn't really seem like there's much the farm system can yield anymore at this point. I don't think we're seeing a young guy coming out of there who's really going to make an emphatic difference. But
Soroka might be back in less than a month.
To me, at least, it's also a question of, you know, what is more legit in a sense? You know, is it the first 2 months of the season where the Braves did just look completely lost and finished? Or is it these last 2 weeks where, I mean, granted, they're not going to go undefeated for the rest of the year, but, you know, what is closer to their true talent level? And like you said, losing Albies is going to hurt, and it's going to, especially because, you know, they've already ruled him out for the next 2 months.
It's going to stay with him. Like, Albies is not going to be 100% the rest of this year. Like, Jared Dickey just went
that's
through that
point.
With Tennessee's outfield. Like, running on it, they're going to be extremely careful. Like, that's such an easy thing to exacerbate that problem. That takes a full offseason of rehab and, like,
rest. That's a good point. This is unfortunately now probably a lost season for Ozzie Albies,
yes.
Which is a real shame. But, you know, given what they already have in play, I mean, I guess that's the thing. Like, if that's the case, do the Braves then decide, okay, we need to go get help at second base because we can't just use Orlando Arcia and Phil Gosselin there. You know, that's simply not good enough.
And there's no one in the pipeline who can be elevated to that spot. There's just no one there.
No.
I mean, maybe you go after Kevin Biggio. Like, he's not a starter in Toronto, and if they don't see him as a guy, I would be interested in a Biggio option there. He seems like someone they would target. I don't know.
But I mean, yeah, there are multiple options for the Braves here. I could see even, you know, trying to add some outfield help if Harris slows down.
Yeah.
And if Adam Duvall slows back down, because it's really clear
Harris
Marcelo...
I think Harris's BABIP's like 375, so I think he's going to come down to earth a little bit.
Yeah, it's really clear Marcelo Ozuna is not an answer out there. Really an answer to anything.
Well, Duvall's hitting a little bit now, though.
But yeah, so it's... I will be interested to see now what the Braves do next. If nothing else, they've put themselves in position where, you know, they're going to be active at the deadline, I think, and they're going to be active buyers, I think. Not that I ever really saw this Braves team selling. I mean, there would have been really no reason for them. They were, even with all this, they were still in wild card position, and this pretty well cements them because, as we talked about last week, there are like 13 total good teams in baseball. But I think what'll be interesting to watch over the next month and a half is where do the Braves decide they need that upgrade and how do they go about getting it? Because if, as you said, like, the farm system is not really in a place to produce the help that they need right away, like, does that mean that the farm system is not in a place to produce the pieces needed to make a trade? You know,
you have a guy like Drew Waters. Like, you wish Drew Waters could play second base, right?
I mean,
now.
I think it says a lot to me that the Braves went with Harris directly over Waters.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to whether or not, I mean, and it, you saw, like, you know, Pache obviously was part of a big deal for a big player, but I wonder if the Braves are at the same place with Waters that they were with Pache, which is the offense is just never going to be there enough for him to be a regular. But regardless, it's definitely going to make the, I'm glad at least that it will make the NL East a little more interesting going forward. I don't really think anyone in baseball, except I guess in this case Mets fans, benefit from a team holding a double-digit lead wire to wire. Essentially, you know, that's not fun for anybody. The Braves and the Phillies coming back to life is a good thing overall.
Yeah, but we'll see. I think it's fine. I think we're moving in the right direction. I think the Braves will be fine going forward. I mean, hey, they may never lose again, like I've said. Who will not be fine is the Detroit Tigers, who lost Casey Mize for not only the rest of this year, but he's gone next year too. Just a blow for the Tigers and this poor kid, man. I mean, just that's a bummer. It's, like, he's gone for a long time, and this just sucks. Like, I don't know what you do with the Tigers.
Things are going real sour there. I mean, like you said, Mize is done for at least the next 16 or so months, thanks to Tommy John. I think more importantly is, like, the moves they made in the offseason, in particular Javi Baez and Eduardo Rodriguez, have really just not worked out.
Baez, do we know what's going on with Eduardo?
There is some speculation that I'm, you know, from what I understand, it is a personal matter, and, you know, I just feel personally like it feels very weird to talk about these guys' personal lives or something like that, but he, even when he was available, he was not producing very much. You know, now there's a question of if he comes back at all this year and what that looks like. Baez has been a straight-up disaster at the plate, and it's obviously, like, the whole worry with Baez was, or has been, given his abysmal plate discipline and just overall, you know.
John, they've been awful everywhere. Like, yeah, Louis, I mean, that's Castro, the thing. I don't Tucker wanna, Barnhart, like, Baez, Austin Meadows, Baez.
Everyone on this team is bad right now. There is
Spencer Torkelson has a WRC plus of 69 right now, 27% nice. K percentage.
Yeah, everything that needed to go right for the Tigers has gone wrong. They've lost their young pitcher, and it's not just Mize. It's Matt Manning being injured. Yep. It's it is. I mean, Tarik Skubal at the very least looks. I mean, I guess that's the thing. The number of successes you can count for the Tigers this season, you could probably do it on one hand if you even need that many fingers. Everything that needed to go right has gone wrong. Baez has not produced. Eduardo Rodriguez has not produced. Torkelson has looked completely overmatched. Riley Green broke his foot right before the season started, and is only just now getting to a point where it looks like he might be back soon. Mm. You know, the young pitching has gotten hurt. The bullpen has been, I mean, who cares about a bullpen on a bad team, you know? Miggy Carrera got to 3,000 hits, but has looked otherwise, like, pretty much like the Miggy Carrera of the last few years, which is to say very old and fossilized, you know? They're still rolling out a lot of guys there, like Willy Castro, or like, you know, just got sent down, but Derek Hill, or like, you know, Robbie Grossman, where it's just, there's just not really a lot of ceiling there, and they just feel like they're just placeholders as opposed to something, you know, kind of the next big thing in Detroit.
Like, there are summers, granted, like, just like, are we trading Michael Pineda? Great, that go Tigers.
And that,
like,
and that's the thing. There's not really anything that this team can do in terms of improving themselves with regards, like, buying to make this team better would take an enormous effort, and quite frankly, is not something I expect the Tigers to do. Selling, there's not really anything, like you said, there's not really anything to sell unless someone's deeply interested in Jonathan Scope or Michael Pineda or Gregory Soto, who I suppose the Tigers could make available, since I don't really know the point of, you know, this of keeping around a relatively good closer in a bad season. Like,
yeah,
but yeah, it's, I mean, I think if you're a Tigers fan, the hope is that, you know, next year, if players are healthy, if Torkelson has development under his belt, if Riley Green has development under his belt, you know, if they're bad, they'll get a good pick in next year's draft too, for whatever that's worth. But yeah, this is, like, the Tigers have a real problem right now. That roster is simply not good enough.
What did Carlos Correa know? That lunch he had with AJ Hinch, he was like, oh, I've got a bad feeling about this one. Well, you're going to have to go with Javier Baez, sir. I'm taking my talents to Minnesota.
I do wonder if this season marks the end of this particular front office's tenure in Detroit.
They've been there a sneaky long time.
And I think at a certain point, like, you know, granted, this is, ownership has not really changed. It's still the Illich family, you know, now it's Chris instead of Mike. Son instead of father, but I don't know how you can look at what Al Avila has done as a general manager there and decide that he should continue on forward. I don't really see what the, you know, what is the reason, you know, what this offseason again was a disaster for Detroit. You know, I know that, you know, we didn't hate it at the time, but it didn't feel like enough of an offseason, and the players they targeted simply aren't producing, and the young players they brought up aren't producing. Pitcher development in Detroit seems to have gone completely haywire. You know, we're talking about, granted, you know, Mize getting hurt is not the fault of the player development staff. Matt Manning getting hurt is not the fault of the player development staff, but they are not producing the way we expect. And we heard about their minor league rotations, like, oh, we have Casey Mize and Matt Manning and Alex Fado and Tarik Skubal. And I was like, you're supposed to be better than this then.
Mm-hmm.
So I do wonder if we're getting at a point where just there needs to be a different leadership in Detroit to try to, I don't know, figure out a different path maybe. But I don't really know where you go with this team, because there's not, I mean, I guess on the plus side for Detroit, with the exception of, I guess now Cabrera, with the exception of Cabrera's, you know, has been the case for a while, and now with, to a certain degree, Rodriguez and Baez, there's not a ton of money on the books going forward. This is not some situation where they're stuck in what the, you know, the baseball equivalent of salary cap hell.
Yeah, they can spend again this winter.
They can spend again this winter, you know, and they'll, and the guys that they're losing to free agency are not guys that they're really going to miss. Barnhart, Pineda, Grossman, Scope, Andrew Chafin, you know, Michael Fulmer, you know, these are not guys who are pieces of the next great Tigers team. The question is, who are those pieces? Who is identifying them? And why hasn't it worked so far?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, just as they're about to start getting out from under Cabrera's contract, you know, his last guaranteed contract year is next year, followed by vesting options that he's almost certainly not going to reach. Well, great. Now, guess how much Baez is owed from 2023 onward? It's not pretty.
Yeah.
It is
I mean, the Baez, like, he's a Tiger
million
for life.
Dollars.
Yeah, that man is a Tiger for a long period of time.
Yeah, $140 million total.
But see, like, that's the thing, too. It's like the hindsight. It's like, we were fine with it. It's like, hey, the Tigers are trying. Baez, yeah. Good.
No, it's fine, but I guess that's the thing. Like, if what you did last offseason didn't work, and it very clearly has not worked, what is the next step here? You know, who of the guys
who
on
has
this
got
card?
Dave Dombrowski's cell phone number on speed dial, because it's time to get him in to jumpstart this thing. We'll trade Avila for
it's also just stuff like there are just so many things, like what happened with Akil Baddoo, for just one example. Like, he was so great for them last year, such an unexpected piece. This year got pushed to the margins for no real discernible reason, didn't really get much in the way of consistent playing time, and then gets sent down afterward. And it's like, okay, well, what exactly is the plan here?
Yeah.
You know, that really should not have happened. It's amazing. I'm just looking at the Tigers lineup right now. They have two semi-regulars
over 100 and WRC plus. Yeah.
That's astonishing. But, like, again, like, should you expect better from Willie Castro or Derek Hill or a 30-year-old Jonathan Scope or Harold Castro? Like, no, these are not building blocks for the future. I think if anything, when we looked at the Tigers, what we kind of missed was, yeah, they've made some additions, but the baseline of that roster is simply not good.
Right.
You know, there's a reason that this team was as bad as it was last year. You know, there's an 85 loss team, and, you know, worse the year before that and worse the year before that. Like, this is, there's just not, this, there was not a large baseline of talent here really to work with. And I think that's going to be the thing for Detroit going forward, is how do you add more talent, particularly given that the player development side doesn't really seem to be producing. You know, again, this is not to say that Torkelson is done and finished and can never be successful going forward, but he's had a really, really rough start.
Almost 200 plate appearances, and they've been bad.
They've been awful, you know. Yeah. And again, with the pitching, like, you know, Skubal and Fado are the lone success stories right now in terms of, and I guess in the bullpen, Alex Lang, who's been terrific. But otherwise, you're not really, you have not really created a renewable, affordable base of talent here, because the answer for this team is not going to be as simple as going out and doing whatever it is they do in free agency next year. You know, that's simply not going to be the case. It's going to be, you know, who can we develop from, or who are the pieces from within who are going to help us get there? Because they just simply need more from what they've already got. And that's going to be tough, because the pieces they've got to, it's you know, what gear is there left for Austin? Is there another gear for Austin Meadows? Like, is Torkelson able to take that next step? What are we what are we going to see out of Riley Greene when he finally debuts? You know, it's going to be tough. The Tigers are in a really tough place right now, and I do think I do think this might actually be the end of Alavila. Like, I'm just not seeing, like, there are not enough success stories, so to speak, on this roster to make up for the fact that this team is, you know, really just not good, you know, and then no real hope of contending this year either.
Go Tigers. Go Tigers. Joe Madden, just an unbelievable ending to what happened in L.A. On a lighter note, he gets a mohawk to change gears here in Los Angeles, and he's fired before he's able to reveal the mohawk to his team, man. How brutal ending for Madden, man.
Rally mohawk, never seen. It's the saddest short story ever written.
God, again, we need a picture. It never came out, right? We never saw it.
No, I had said before that the Tommy Pham, Jock Peterson, fantasy football dust-up was the funniest story in baseball this year. Never mind. Joe Madden getting a mohawk and never even getting a chance to unveil it, which also means that was when he was in the meeting getting let go, was he just sitting there with a mohawk?
Yes.
Like, did Perry Manassian and company, were they just like... What's with the you're fired, but like I want video of Joe Madden sitting through his dismissal with a mohawk. Like, I that image is so perfect to me and so perfectly encapsulates his wacky stepdad nonsense that, like, man,
how do you do, fellow kids?
What a beautiful image. He very much is how do you do, fellow kids. And
what's the craziest hairstyle you ever did, John?
I've never done a crazy one. No, my hair's always been pretty much the same forever. I don't really have the ability to grow it out. It just kind of grows up, like, kind of froze.
Interesting. But you never did that though.
I never did that though. No, I don't like the way it looks. It just looks too much, and just gets too hairy and fuzzy. I look just like a cotton ball more than anything. Okay. But I've never done the mohawk though. I've never had the chance to do that.
I never did a mohawk growing up, but I did do. I had frosted tips. I did the frosted tips. I did the highlights.
Very good.
Definitely. Young Chase, man, there were some looks.
Frosted tips is very A-Rod.
I mean, hey, look, I had the chain, the frosted tips. It was a look, man. I was out here. All vibes, all gas, no brakes at Trickham Middle School for me. Is it time, John Taylor, for the Chicago White Sox to fire Coach La Russa? Is this it? Do you think he gets fired? One, and do you think it's time?
I don't think he gets fired, no, because the only person who will make that decision is Jerry Reinsdorf, and Jerry Reinsdorf seems blind to reason and logic right now. And regardless, I think it's something that probably wouldn't happen until the end of the season anyway. Should they? Probably.
I don't know. Like, I think the season's slipping. Like, this is like...
Oh, I'd say the season is very much slipping for the Chicago White Sox.
You have nothing to lose at this point. You have nothing to lose.
I mean, the metric in my mind is, like, what is this manager doing to help the team be better? Mm-hmm. And in La Russa's case, I'm not really sure what the argument is, because we all just watched him intentionally walk someone with two strikes on purpose. Like, that, I mean... To me, it's not even necessarily the decision itself, although the decision is a very, very bad decision without any real defense, despite what La Russa insists otherwise. It's the doubling down on that. It's the stubbornness. It's the arrogance of, I'm Tony La Russa, therefore I must be right. You know, I know more than the rest of you. And it's like, that's just simply not that. How can you manage like that? Especially in this day and age when there's so much information around the game and to how to manage the game and to how to put your players in the best position to succeed. La Russa does not seem like he does that.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't seem to trust young players. It's telling to me that amidst all of this, Yermín Mercedes got just straight up let go by the team. He was a big story last year briefly, and I don't necessarily think he was a sustainable story, but the way La Russa treated him in particular after that whole mess over him homering on a 3-0 pitch,
That feels like forever ago.
Blowout.
Yeah,
like, this team doesn't seem to do a very good job handling young players. La Russa's bullpen management seems very just not. It just doesn't seem to. This doesn't seem to hold any logic to it. It just seems to
Kopech's
be
gone.
It seems to be just based on whims. Like, granted, they're getting crushed by injuries right now.
Yes.
But at the same time, like, this does not seem like a manager who knows how to get the most out of the squad, nor does it seem like a manager who's particularly in touch with what's going on with this team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this does not seem like, the White Sox don't seem like a particularly happy bunch. And it's not a surprise that that's the case given their cranky septuagenarian manager who thinks it's a good idea to intentionally walk guys on a two-strike count. Like, I don't know. I mean, you can definitely see. I wonder if the White Sox look at what happened with the Phillies, in particular with Joe Girardi, another guy who's very set in his ways and definitely did not seem to have the clubhouse behind him, and wonder, you know, is that us as well? But I don't know. I just don't see it happening, though, because, again, this is Jerry Reinsdorf's call. It's very much not Rick Hahn's call, just as it was Jerry Reinsdorf's call to hire Tony La Russa. And I think that's going to make it that much harder for the White Sox to move on from him, because there's only one guy making that decision, and he's Tony La Russa's friend. You know, if I'm in charge of the White Sox, no. I mean, Tony La Russa's not there in the first place, but he's especially not there anymore. You know, what has he done or shown over the course of the season to make you think that he is the right man to lead this team going forward?
If I was a White Sox fan, I'd be so pissed off about all of this right now.
Oh, the ones I know online are very, very pissed off. You know,
like, this is just a nightmare. There is no excuse for this team not to be the best team in the AL Central and to be contending during this run with this group. Like, it's just,
It's a combination of cheapness on the part of ownership. It's a combination of poor planning on the part of the front office. And I think it's a combination of bad managerial choices and decisions by La Russa. You know,
I think this offseason you need to start from scratch.
I think so. Reinsdorf holds the keys. So, you know, Tony La Russa goes as far as Reinsdorf thinks he will go. But I would not be surprised if at the very least Rick Hahn is gone at the end of this year if the White Sox continue to struggle like this. Because I think you're right. Like, this team should not be struggling.
This is the AL Central. Like, this is...
Even beyond the AL Central, this is a team with so much talent.
Right.
Like, they should not be struggling like this. They should not be this bad defensively. They should not be this inept when it comes to hitting right-handers. They should not be, you know, this much of a depth. They have no depth on that team.
Just right.
None whatsoever. And again, a lot of injuries, but you're not getting the sense of a team that is well... Again, like with the Tigers, you don't get the sense of a team that is well-run. You know, just a team that's kind of stumbling from place to place and trying to figure out how that all works.
Oh, Tigers, man. The AL Central, what a dumpster fire.
It really is.
Ryu, gone for the season for the Jays. This is not really a surprise based on how he's been pitching to this point. It has been a struggle for him. Toronto, probably, they're going to have to do something. Berrios, they're probably still betting on bouncing back. Like, he's still got... The expectation should be that he'll figure it out and he'll bounce back and we'll be better down the stretch. But in terms of where they go now, I'm curious because he's a high-priced guy and he has been a really good player for them and a really good pitcher in this league for a while. But I don't know. Like, this is fascinating because I think they need another starter. They're an extremely good ball club. They can obviously hit all across the board, but... they need more depth in this rotation now. And I'm curious, like, they call up the guy that right after we get off the podcast, you texted me and you're like, oh, guess who just got called up? And that's just how it works with podcasting and all that kind of stuff. But I'm so curious. Do you think it's a situation where Jansen, who I think was Ryu's primary catcher, do I have that right?
I don't know off the top of my head, no.
I think it was, though. I'm pretty certain it was him. And if Ryu's gone... that makes a Jansen trade probably a little bit easier, but...
I mean, I still don't think they move Jansen, if only because, again, they don't... like, Alejandro Kirk is not really a catcher. I mean, he's a catcher, but he's not a great catcher, and I don't really know that the Jays want to put themselves in a position where their catching tandem is dude who's not a great defensive catcher and rookie. That's really, really tough.
Mm.
So, I don't really see that. Again, even with Moreno getting called up earlier than, you know, than I predicted... I still don't think this is a situation that resolves itself until the off season, because it also is just going to be much easier to move a catcher then, unless there's a team out there right now desperate for catching help that will give whatever the Blue Jays want for Jansen.
Yeah, it was Jansen, by the way, with Ryu. There.
I think the bigger question for the Jays is, like you said, you know, now that Ryu is officially gone, and regardless of whether he has full Tommy John or partial, he's almost certainly not pitching again. Or if he has full Tommy John, he's not pitching against the season. If he has partial, he's also still not pitching against the season.
Like, it's over. You're writing him off for this year.
So your rotation right now is Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, Alek Manoah, Yusei Kikuchi, and Ross Stripling. Stripling has been very good since taking over for Ryu in the rotation.
But don't want to go into the postseason betting on Ross Stripling.
No, and there's also no depth behind that, and we still have a lot of seasons still left. The Blue Jays minor league, upper minor leagues, does not really have much in the way of starting depth. I think the big X factor here, as he has been seemingly for the last like 2.5 years, is Nate Pearson. And what the Blue Jays think they can get out of him, what role would be best for him, etc. But right now, you know, he is still working his way back from mononucleosis that he had contracted over the spring, and he's never a guy that the Jays have been able to rely on before, given all his injury issues, particularly with his arm. So, no, this is not a situation, I think, where the Jays can just sit back and go, oh, okay, we'll be fine, you know, we'll just make it work. I think they probably are going to add some starting pitching depth, but I think given the presence of Gausman and Manoah and Berríos, they probably don't feel the need to add an ace-level arm. I think they might be one of those teams that, you know, when we talked about like Jose Quintana last week, maybe this is one of those teams that looks at Quintana as guys, you know, just someone in the back of the rotation or who's around who can give them 4 or 5 innings. Part of that's going to depend on health. Part of that is going to depend on how much they, you know, what role they prefer for Stripling, whether they want him to be a starter, whether they want him to be a reliever, whether, you know, what kind of starter or reliever they want him to be. But I do think with Ryu gone, the Blue Jays are almost certainly going to have to add some kind of starting depth one way or the other.
Tucker Davidson for Kevin Biggio. Who says no?
Both parties? I don't know if either side wants to make that deal. But I don't think that they can make, because right now their rotation is, you know, they have a 5-man rotation, but there is not really a viable 6-starter kind of waiting in the wings for them. You know, unless they think Pearson is ready a lot sooner or is already ready, or if they're ready to try stuff like Casey Lawrence or Bowden Francis, or go back to guys like Anthony Kay and Thomas Hatch, who have, you know, gotten shots in the past, especially with other teams that have never really been able to make them work. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I do think that the loss of Ryu will make Toronto do something with regards to adding some starting pitching depth. I just think it's going to be something closer to like a 4-5 arm as opposed to a 1-2 or 3 guy.
Twins, because they can also not have nice things. Man, AL Central, a lot of crap this week.
A lot of problems
thrown
Central.
To the AL Central. Royce Lewis gone. Not Byron Buxton, but Royce Lewis, another
so
crappy situation.
The fact that it's the same, it's another ACL injury. Yeah. It's another lost year for him, and a total calendar year, 12 months. It's so brutal. And he was playing so well too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just illustrative too of just the Twins have had to deal with so many injuries. You know, we talked about this last week and I think previously too, that like what they have done in the face of all that is really, really remarkable. They've had some tremendous depth, but now they're starting to lose that depth too. Like Royce Lewis was a big part of that. You know, he was a guy who could and did plug in for Carlos Correa when he was out.
Yes.
Someone who maybe could have offered them some outfield depth in case Buxton got hurt again, or if something happens with Max Kepler, who's never been a picture of perfect health, or with you know, the other players they have floating around the outfield. It's really tough. And at
isn't
a
it crazy
point,
that like he has 2 ACLs? Like that's just one of those things. He's in great shape. He doesn't
it's like Soroka tearing his Achilles tendon twice. It's, I mean, I guess that's the thing.
It's just unexplainable.
Well, those things, there's probably an explanation to those things when surgically repaired are just never going to be as strong as they originally were, and that the possibility or chance of re-injury is by default higher. But no, it's a really crappy break for Lewis. It's just really bad luck. And you do wonder when the Twins reach the point where they just cannot survive all these injuries anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, they've survived them thus far, and it obviously helps that, you know, Chicago has been a walking disaster. But, you know, Cleveland is right there, and, you know, is certainly not, does, I don't think, has the ceiling that Minnesota does, but
they don't,
you know,
want to be there.
They don't want to be there. Yeah, are we going to get a real life major league situation where they're just going to start cutting like everything going forward?
Oh my god!
They're going to have a picture of Paul Dolan in a bikini just up in the clubhouse, just taking pieces off of it one at a time.
That's the most 2022 state of Major League Baseball scenario that we could also put together. That's also maybe a possibility. Like, I want Cleveland to just be forced into winning the AL Central this year.
So they can just sit there and be like, we don't want this.
We don't want
the
playoffs.
This.
Yeah.
Do you know how much more money it costs to be in the playoffs? But yeah, it's definitely a question of like how much more the Twins' depth can really you know, survive. Like, yeah, they've lost so much. Like, and like the guys that they've been relying on, you know, Chichi Gonzalez, Tyler Thornburg, you know, Yenir Cano, whoever that was. Mm-hmm. You know, they've had to pull really, really deep. And at a certain point, you just not either you run out of options, or you know, you roll a dice enough times, sometimes one is going to come up. That's just math. You know, some of these guys just aren't going to work out. They're not going to produce. They're not going to give you what you need. I mean, the lucky thing, I guess, for the Twins is you look at their full lineup right now, and, you know, yeah, they're down Miguel Sano. They are down Lewis now. But otherwise, you know, they have, for the most part, a good enough solid starting lineup with, you know, with productive players that they can make this work. You know, it's just going to be the big question for me, one, is the rotation, because that rotation is just bad right now. This was a concern going into the season. It looked better for a little bit there, but it has gone back to being a real, real problem for the Twins, and they really need to do something about that. But also just, I mean, again, you look at their injured list. It's Sano, Royce Lewis, Sonny Gray's back now, but Bailey Ober, Chris Paddock, Kenta Maeda, Randy Dobnak, Josh Winder, Jorge Acala, Danny Colombe. Like, there's a lot of guys on there. There are a lot of guys on there, and some of them are obviously more useful than others, but they are really having to dip deep into their farm system and into minor league free agency to fill these holes. And at a certain point, you just run out of bodies. And I'm starting to worry that the Twins are just getting closer and closer to that point where they just don't have enough. They don't have enough bodies to make it through. And again, you're already seeing that in the rotation. You know, Joe Ryan is back and Sonny Gray is back, but the next three starters in that group are Dylan Bundy, Devin Smelter, and Chris Archer. That's really, really bad. That's not going to do it. So, yeah, but yeah, just the main thing. It just sucks for Lewis. It's always rough to see a guy deal with something like that. I felt the same.
Super
about
talented guy too.
Yeah, I felt the same about Kyle Lewis too, coming back from that knee injury he had, and then immediately suffering a concussion. You know, it's just this game is really unfair sometimes. You know, especially for guys who've already struggled.
What's his name? You brought concussion. Local Loganville kid, Clint Frazier, and like the Cubs, where that's like one of those where I don't know how you explain DFAing Frazier and keeping Hayward. Like, that doesn't really, that's like one of those things where,
yeah, that's
why
there must be something else there or something behind the scenes that we don't know about, because on the surface that does not really make any sense.
That's one of those where I'm like, I want to be in the room, like, explain this to me.
Yeah,
like,
I'm not particularly high on Clint Frazier. I think he's a second
but he's
division
just
starter.
You keep him around between
but
him
that's
and Hayward
the thing.
At this
he's a young player with some upside, you know, mm-hmm. whereas Hayward, you know what he is at this point, which is to say a very expensive contract. There's not really anything left Jason Hayward is going to produce for you at this point in time. You know, it's extremely unlikely. So, yeah, I can't say I really get that one either.
We'll end on this, John. Really good piece in Fangraphs this week by old friend Dan Zembrowski on Noah Syndergaard's comeback season and why it's complicated. What would you make of Dan's piece?
So, I mean, he makes a point that the main issue with Syndergaard right now is that the strikeouts just aren't there. Mm-hmm. And that makes it a question of, okay, if the strikeouts aren't there, how does Noah Syndergaard go forward, you know? And mm-hmm. part of Dan's piece is noting that, well, without the strikeouts, his projections with Dan Zipp's projection system, his projections look very, very poker. You know, we're talking a guy with an ERA over four, or projected ERA over four for the next 5 years. Granted, that's not going to be the Angels' problem going forward. Syndergaard's only there on a one-year deal. You know, if they want him back, they can bring him back. If they don't, he goes somewhere else. But it's really, and the point Dan makes, I think, is a really good one, that you can survive with a low strikeout rate that is not, you know, a career killer, but it does mean that there's no margin for error anymore, and that when you start losing from that point, then you're really, really screwed. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a matter of how Syndergaard adjusts. One thing Dan points out is that Syndergaard in two strike counts has really struggled, in part because the pitches he, you know, was such a demon with in two strikes previously in his career, his changeup and his slider, they don't seem to be getting the same result. I imagine part of that is just the fastball does not get the same results. Hitters are no longer having to gear up for it in the same way, especially because his velocity is not really there anymore. But yeah, it does mean that I think we're going to have to see Noah Syndergaard make that transition from being a thrower into a pitcher. He's going to have to figure out how to get ahead when he doesn't have 99-mile-an-hour sinkers and 93-mile-an-hour changeups and wipe out 95-mile-an-hour sliders. He's going to have to figure out how to get by with diminished stuff. Some dudes can do it, some dudes can't. And, yeah.
Do you think he will?
I don't know. It's hard to say now. Certainly the results right now don't look good. He's allowing a lot of contact and, again, just not really getting strikeouts, and it's really, really hard to survive as a pitcher that way. But, you know, there's still the rest of the season to go to see if he can figure something out. You know, I at least will be interested to see if and what Syndergaard changes over the course of the rest of the season, because, I mean, that is the other thing for him. Like I said, he's only with the Angels on a one-year deal. He has to re-enter the free agent market next year. And if he's going into it the same pitcher he is right now, a guy with a strikeout rate of around 6, you know, an ERA in the high 3s and low 4s, he's not going to get a whole lot of interest from teams. You know, they're not
going to
be.
You're going to Texas, sir.
Maybe that's what's best for him. I mean, it's hometown, although I don't know if he was closer to Houston or Dallas.
Either would be fine with him.
I'm sure either would be fine, but yeah, it's definitely going to raise a question then. If this is the same Noah Syndergaard we see in the offseason, who's still going to be interested in him, and is there going to be another chapter to his career? Because right now, I mean, the Syndergaard we're seeing is not, a, I mean, the Syndergaard we're seeing is no different really than Chris Archer. And, you know, that Chris Archer is not a guy who looks like he has a particularly long time left in baseball at this point.
Mm. John Taylor, what can the good folks check out over at Fangraphs.com, along with the great piece by Dan? I know you've got a lot of Braves coverage, so I appreciate your influence when Meg's like, what should we put on the front page? And you're like, hey, here's this Braves thing.
Y'all Graphs.
We're
going to have even more Braves coverage coming. Dan is going to have a piece on your boy, Dansby Swanson, looking at his hot streak, and especially in the context of, one, is this sustainable? Two, what does this look like for him going forward? As you mentioned, he is a free agent this offseason, and without looking off the top of my head, I would gather he will probably be one of the better infielders available, especially defensively, although, I don't know, is Swanson a...
He's an elite defender.
That's what I've thought. But beyond that, we have, as you mentioned, our Braves coverage. Eric Longenhagen made a couple changes to his top 100. Michael Harris being a big part of that because our Braves list is not out yet, although it will be coming relatively soon. Beyond that, just the usual good Fangraphs stuff, you know, interviews, pieces on the game as it is, Ben Clemens doing weird stat stuff. It's all there. It's all fun.
I need a day in the life of Ben Clemens. That's what I want. A video, YouTube, add it to the YouTube page. I guarantee it'll get the clicks.
I imagine Ben spends a lot of the day staring at the ceiling before he just kind of goes, I've got it, and then just starts writing something perfect. So that's what I like to think.
Because his story idea is like, I would kill to have that. Like when I'm perusing stuff and I'm trying to figure out and then hit this guy over here, just some weird nugget out of nowhere. You're like, man, that would be great. That would be great to have a brain that works like that.
Yeah, but yeah, come on to Fair. I especially recommend folks check out the top 100 thing. Obviously, as we get more and more into the summer, we're going to get more and more prospect stuff. The big one there that I like is Eric writing about Yuri Perez, a 19-year-old Marlins pitcher, is 6'9", but has struck out, or 6'9", now 19. He's throwing 96-98 with really hard sliders. Eric has had scouts tell him that, you know, Perez might be the best pitching prospect in the game right now. So
there's one thing the Marlins need. It's more dominant,
more good
pitching
prospects. Exactly. Yeah. Highly recommend you go check out that piece in particular if you're a prospect person. It's very, very thorough, as all of Eric's prospect stuff is. But yeah, come on down to Fangraphs. Sign up for a membership while you're here. Help support the cool work we're doing. And come check out our baseball stuff. It's good.
It is good. Go do that. Subscribe today. Yallgraphs.com. People forget. Yeah. There you go. John Taylor, always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and I'll talk to you next week. All right, that'll do it for hour one here on the Wednesday, June 15th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Owens Podcast and the Blue Wire Pod Network. Go to bluewirepods.com today and check out all of our great pods all across the Blue Wire Pod Network. So go do that today. That'd be great. And if you enjoyed hour one here and you have not already done so, please make sure that you leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify if that is indeed how you listen to today's program. Hour two coming up on all things Pitt Panther football in just 1 second. But thank you, as always, for spending part of your Wednesday with me. Or if you're listening to it later in the week, that's good too. I just appreciate you making the Chase Owens Podcast part of your listening schedule. So greatly appreciate it, guys, as always. And I will talk to y'all in just one bit. Uncle Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.